Hey, Greg.
What? Yeah?
Are you asleep already?
I am.
Wake up. It's time to science.
Woohoo. Science. Science, science.
Yeah.
Science me.
Yep. Well.
I got my coffee.
We're going to science the shit out of it. Yeah, so we haven't talked hard science in quite some time. And so it's time to do that again. Hooray.
All right. The best part.
Everybody loves the hard science.
Oh, yeah. This is when we go through the list of what's been published lately and what's in queue and go, what haven't we done? Ooh, Greg hasn't taken a nap during the recording in a while.
Correct. Exactly.
Let me have it. What are we doing?
Photosynthesis.
Oh, see, I'm pretty sure I have my kid's biology book around here somewhere. And I know there's a picture of a plant and it's got an arrow to the stamen and an arrow to the sunlight and the little sun rays coming down. So I know photosynthesis. We all know this.
And the fact that stamen has nothing to do with photosynthesis?
It's
well done.
It's in the plant somewhere.
It's part of the thing that does the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. This is why we need to talk about it. And apparently you need to go back to 8th grade science class.
10th grade science class, thank you very much.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Wrong kid.
Public school children. Okay. So, yeah, we're going to talk about photosynthesis today. Photosynthesis.
Usually I'm the one that pronounces everything wrong.
And as it's specific to hops and yield, there's some recent data out that looks at the activity, photosynthetic activity of six different varieties and their response to different temperatures. And it's really interesting. And they did this. This was the USDA ARS Forage Seed and Cereal Research Unit in Corvallis. This was done specifically because, and they mentioned it several times in this paper, because of A, increasingly more normal high temperatures in the Pacific Northwest, and growers, non-traditional hop growers in other regions of the country and the world. That's the first time I've seen that as a reason, like in the abstract for a scientific paper, is actual hardcore hop research coming out of Corvallis, Oregon for non-traditional hop growers.
That's awesome. That's very encouraging. That's great because as we've seen, I mean, the ridiculously vast majority just comes out of the Pacific Northwest, and those production practices are what everything's usually focused on because, let's face it, they have the money to do the research.
Yep, exactly. So now we're looking at non-traditional folks in other areas asking the same questions like, which varieties should I grow and why does these varieties work great for me here but not there? Now, let's not kid ourselves. I mean, their primary reason for doing this was because of the shift in increasing extreme temperatures in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. They didn't do this specifically for us. However, they tied it in nicely by saying, yeah, there are other people in other parts of the country and other parts of the world that are doing this where hops were never a commercial crop, and we didn't know anything about what to tell them about what varieties to grow where. Is there any kind of trend? Turns out there is, and now we know why.
So this is actually them being respectful and nice as opposed to the Minnesota nice you taught me about last time.
That's correct. Okay. Yes, this is
real
good science.
Real good science. Okay.
This is good science, yeah. So I figured let's talk about that. Let's take a dive. I'm not sure how deep we're going to go, but let's take a dive into the photosynthesis apparatus. And let's talk about all these things that are related to how a plant gets energy, how it uses that energy, and why it's important to yield, and what happens to this plant during different stages of its life cycle. How's that sound?
Sounds good to me.
Good.
I'm still going to use those silly pictures from my kid's textbook in the Instagrams, though.
I'm sure you are. Yeah, but that's fine. You can do that. I'm sure, like I said, this is something that you first hear about in like fifth grade, and it's the biggest word that you've ever seen in your life at that point. In a nutshell, photosynthesis, what is it? Well, it's the process that a plant goes through in order to capture energy from sunlight, photons, and then use that energy to take carbon dioxide and turn it into sugars. That's what it does. That's in a nutshell, that's its process. This all takes place in an organelle, as we call organelles, tiny little specialized, quote, organs inside of a cell called the chloroplast. And the chloroplast contains chlorophyll, which is green. That's the mechanism that chlorophyll is what's doing the capturing of energy from the sun. So in order for it to work, you kind of got to have sun shining on the leaf, right? That's where the most of the chloroplasts are. Now, another paper I read looked at the photosynthetic activity and capacity of hop cones, like bracts on hop cones and stems and anything that's green on the hop plant. Because you'd think, well, if it's green, it's photosynthesizing. And so it's producing energy and producing sugars and all that good kind of stuff, right? Wrong. No, it's green. Other parts of the plant are green so that it doesn't basically kill itself through being overstimulated by sunlight. And that's a process called photooxidation. I'll talk about that in a second. But so we're talking specifically about leaves here. All leaves are not created equal when it comes to their ability or their efficiency in converting sunlight into sugar and then into yield.
I guess the brown leaves on the brown moldy hops are not doing a great job of this.
Not so much, yeah. And nor are those all tattered leaves near the bottom, right? As leaves get older, they lose their efficiency. The reason I started thinking about this photosynthesis as a topic is because there was I saw a lot of chatter about how many binds to train and what's the magic number. Right? Do I need to train 4 binds? Do I need to train 6 binds per string? Well, why don't I just put up 10 strings and train everything? And the easy answer, the first one everybody goes to, is, well, you put up too many strings, or too many binds, and you're going to shade. If the solar panel isn't getting sunshine, it's not producing electricity, right? So the leaf isn't getting sunshine, it's not producing sugars, and is not going to equate to yield. But James, it's still green. There's still light bouncing around. Yeah, no, not so much. Really, we can take a look at these 5 or 6 papers, scientific papers, and it's pretty clear that shaded hop leaves have minuscule to no what we call carbon fixing or sugar producing activity going on. If those leaves aren't in sun, they're not doing their thing. So shading, number one, for hop growers, as you're training, think about that. Think about how many binds you're training up a string. And if you've got, you see these pictures of these big, bushy hop plants going up these strings, and they're like, you know, a meter wide, and it's nothing but just this giant column of green foliage, right?
Yeah, and it looks gorgeous.
And there's no sidearms. Mm-hmm. It's because those leaves are all so shaded that they can't produce enough sugars in order to add the biomass that they need. Straight up, end of story, good night, Charlie. That's the way it works. Fewer binds with, you know, healthy leaves are going to be way more higher yielding plants than those where you're training up a bunch of binds.
And it's interesting because you think about limited resources like water and fertilizer and whatnot, where you're thinking about how many plants are out there. The sun is limitless. It's there for you. But yeah, the overcrowding gets in the way quickly.
Big time. Big time. Let's roll that back a little bit. So that's sort of where this whole concept of this topic came from. So let's roll back. And we were talking about sunlight going into this chloroplast. And the chlorophyll is a molecule that is very, obviously very, very important. Without it, we're not going to be able to get any energy from the sun.
So when you hear me say, even I know that, you know it's important.
It is important. Mm-hmm. Energy from the sun, photons, light is hitting this chloroplast. Inside the chloroplast is the chlorophyll if you look at this molecule, you can look it up online. It looks like a giant antenna cluster. It's got all these little danglies, right, sticking out there. It's 100% about harvesting energy from the sun. And how does it do that? Does it actually grab a light particle, like a photon? No, it doesn't do that. What happens is the energy from the sun, the energy in that photon strikes these little antennae dangly molecules that are out there and excites the electrons in this molecule and starts the what we call the electron shuffle. As energy is basically, you can think of this thing as a very delicate, spidery antenna. Just like think of it like a spider web, right? An insect gets on it and it sends a vibration through the whole thing, and that energy is picked up, right, by the spider, and it knows it's there and he can go do his thing. Same thing happens with the chlorophyll, is that the energy is hitting this delicate molecule, sending vibrations through it, and those vibrations are basically excited electrons.
And I'm looking at the molecule now, and you're describing it well. It has a very long tail. What it looks like when I look at it is a mace on the end of a chain that you're swinging around.
Yep. Yep. And so all of those danglies, right, that are vibrating from the energy from the sun, is sending all those that energy down into that main tail, so that you can sort of focus all of those, the electrons that are being stimulated, to get them to do something for you. So this is the what we call the light harvesting complex of photosynthesis. It's not grabbing a photon, right? But that photon, that little packet of light in a wavelength, is striking and conveying some energy. And then the chlorophyll is all about grabbing it and sending that energy someplace where the plant can use it. So it's sending all this energy to, it's actually, we call it the electron transport chain, where it's all about taking that energy and moving it to different molecules to get that energy to do different things, to create different types of molecules. One of the main molecules, I think you could argue the main molecule for life to exist as we know it, is called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. This is the molecule that every living cell uses, for the most part, to move energy around. That's it. That's how we take light and convert it into chemical energy. That's what we're trying to do. All those electrons, they travel down this chain in the chlorophyll, and they end up interacting with this compound called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Sort of like you got a depleted, what we call ADP, adenosine diphosphate, so it's a di, not a tri, that comes into the chloroplast to get charged up. It's sort of like a dead battery. So it comes in as a di, it gets charged up by the light energy that comes out of the chloroplast, and another phosphorus. Because it's diphosphate, we need it to be triphosphate. So it's got to have a phosphorus from somewhere. Where's that coming from?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
One more. Phosphorus, is it going to be getting it from the what you're putting in the ground? I mean, we talk about phosphorus as an additive you need for your soil.
Exactly.
Woohoo!
And it's a primary nutrient. This is one of the reasons. Pretty important molecule, or pretty important element, nutrient to be part of this whole cycle. It's coming in as ADP, getting charged up. Another phosphate gets tacked on there because that takes energy to do that. Where's that energy coming from? It's coming from the sun that the chlorophyll is harvesting in the chloroplast. Gets charged up to ATP. Now that baby's ready to go and do some work. So that's what we call photosystem one. That's the light harvesting complex. So now we've taken energy from the sun. We've managed to convert it into chemical energy. Now that's something the rest of the plant can use to do something. You haven't created any food yet, though. All you've done is create energy. Mm-hmm. Harvested energy, can't create it. You've harvested and changed it. Now we have to make some food. That's where CO2 comes in. Because the other thing you learn about in fifth grade with photosynthesis is that plants take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. And isn't that beautiful? Because we use oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. It's a lovely, lovely ballet imbalance.
Mm-hmm. That's usually, you know, part and parcel with this is why we don't step on the plants.
That's part of it, yes. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why life exists on Earth today is because of all of that blue-green algae kicking off oxygen back in the way back.
the very way back, like pre-COVID?
Yeah, way pre-COVID. Okay. CO2 comes into the plant. How's it come into the plant? Tiny little open mouths on the leaf called stomata. And they are. They look like little open mouths in the, if you look at them under the microscope, little pores. And that's where gases exchange, and that's where water leaves the plant. So we're sucking in CO2, and it goes through this process called the Calvin cycle. And the Calvin cycle is a whole nother chain of chemical reactions that's fueled by this ATP. To take that CO2, that's a gas, rearrange the atoms in it, and produce sugar out the other end, glucose. That's it. That's what happens. That's what goes on inside of this thing we call a chloroplast, is you've got one part of the photosynthetic mechanism, photosystem one, producing the energy in the form of ATP, and then you have photosystem two that's working to move those electrons around, and then you've got this Calvin cycle that's produced taking CO2 and making sugar. That's how photosynthesis works.
It's pretty straightforward, but. Oh, there's the but. Okay.
But. there's a few buts here. The efficiency of this system is heavily dependent on optimum conditions, environmental conditions. Plant can't exactly move around, right? If it's too hot, it can't go into the air conditioning. So what is it going to do? It has to be able to withstand a wide range of environmental conditions. It also needs, all this is happening, all this process is happening in water. So obviously we need a lot of water to make this thing go. Water is also leaving the stomata when they're opened as part of the byproduct of this whole process. So we need a lot of water, we need sunlight, and we need the right temperature. The efficiency of that whole photosystem, it appears, based on the data that I was just talking about, to be different in different varieties. The ability of this plant to what we call fix carbon, take that CO2 and turn it into sugar, the ability for the plant to do that, or the photosystems to do that, is heavily dependent on temperature, water, and it is variety dependent. Well, that seems weird. Hops are hops. Why would they be different by variety? That's so bizarre. It seems to me, right, and probably the rest of you, that this is a very basic function of the plant. It shouldn't be like changing around between varieties. What the hell's that all about? Well, I'm here to tell you that there's other things going on in your plant besides just photosynthesis. So all of these processes are mediated by enzymes. And those enzymes are the ones that are very sensitive to temperature. And when temperature goes too high, the enzymes stop working, or their efficiency certainly goes to hell. And these processes I've been talking about, slow, they come to a stop, they become inefficient. Even some plants start leaking juice. It's called electrolyte leakage, where the actual membrane around this chloroplast gets leaky, gets super fluid because it gets too hot. And when you start leaking out electrolytes, things generally go bad.
They're sweating, look, basically.
Well, they're sweating. They're more like, they're not sweating from like, I'm too hot, I've got to cool myself off. It's more like, you ever take out a crusty old battery from an electronics?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's electrolyte leakage. Not a good thing. It's not something you really can fix.
Can't just pour Gatorade on the plant and be done with it?
Not so much, no.
All right.
Where are we going with this? I told you about...
I'm just here to distract what? You. You know this.
I know. Yes, you are doing a good job. We talked about photosynthesis, what the process is. We talked about how it produces energy for the plant in the form of sugar from carbon dioxide. In that process, you give off oxygen. That's a byproduct, and water. So you produce all this sugar. You're like, okay, great. Yep, the plant's making food for itself. That's awesome. I'm providing fertilizer as a grower because all of these other nutrients are needed as part of that plant's ability to feed itself. So the plant's producing sugar that's used as the metabolic fuel to do what it's going to do. And to add carbon to actually build its biomass. But you got to burn that sugar in order to release the energy that you just captured through photosynthesis, right? So you've used light to change energy into chemical energy from light energy. That's all that photosynthesis is. Now you've got all this energy in this molecule you're going to eat in order to give you energy to do stuff when the sun isn't around. Seems pretty reasonable.
It does.
The act of burning energy is called respiration, which is what you and I do. Mm-hmm. Right? That's how we take in food through our pie hole. It's not always pie, but hopefully it's a lot of pie in there. Mm-hmm. And we go through this metabolic process to take that chemical energy, break it down to turn it into a lot of biomass that many of us are experiencing through COVID. And we give off CO2 when that happens as a byproduct. Oxygen's required as part of that process to get in there and basically break things up, break things down, turn that chemical energy back into other types of metabolic energy. Plants do the same thing. So this whole idea of, oh, plants taking CO2 and give off oxygen, isn't that great? But they also take in oxygen and give off CO2 through respiration. And they're doing this typically at night. You're like, wait a minute, James, so you mean it? Actually, where's all this oxygen come from then if it's using its own oxygen that it created earlier in the day? Well, it's not necessarily a one-for-one exchange. It's giving off more oxygen during photosynthesis than it's consuming during respiration. That's one of those aha things that a lot of people don't know about. They're like, oh, wow, it is. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, now you know.
So are, out of curiosity, are humans the same way? Are we taking in some degree of CO2 for any type of process?
Not really.
No?
No, we're just hogs, oxygen hogs.
So really the plants don't need us, is what it comes down
plants
to.
Plants have never needed us, no. Ever. No. They don't need us, silly boy.
So much for that whole circle of life.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so much. Anyway. So, okay, I've explained CO2. Respiration is the process of burning that sugar in order to build biomass and to grow as a plant. What does that mean for us as a hop grower? Well, I told you I've got some of these great papers that I found. One of the best ones is from a scientific article called Hort Science. Photosynthetic activity of 6 hop cultivars under different temperature treatments. And they looked at Cascade, Centennial, Chinook, Pride of Ringwood, Southern Brewer, and Willamette as a cross-section of varieties in different parts of the world. Obviously, Cascade, Centennial, Chinook, and Willamette are Pacific Northwest varieties. Southern Brewer was bred in South Africa to be less sensitive to day length. It's a whole other story. And Pride of Ringwood comes from our friends in Australia. And what we looked at here is we looked at photosynthesis itself, so we can actually measure this with a special meter, chlorophyll fluorescence meter. And then we want to also look at the ability of this plant to assimilate carbon. So it's that second part of that photosystem where it's taking in CO2 and fixing it as sugar. That's really the best measure of photosynthesis efficiency. The plant can harvest way more light energy than it can use. The best measure of this whole apparatus is how efficient is it at turning that energy, light energy, into chemical energy through carbon assimilation. And that is all controlled by enzymes. And you just heard me say enzymes are temperature sensitive, mm-hmm. little monsters. And what we can see here, and we'll post this paper on our webpage. If you look at these temperatures, they looked at temperatures ranging from 15 degrees Celsius to 45 degrees Celsius. So cool to freaking hot. And they found, in general, these different cultivars all followed the same trend. What they found was that they reach their maximum carbon assimilation in that 24 to 36 degrees Celsius range. which is a lovely temperature. 36 could be a little bit high. But certainly the most efficient, or the, I should say the highest rates of carbon assimilation were happening right around that 24 to 27 degrees.
And just to make sure everyone understands, I mean, 36 degrees you're talking about is the sweet spot. That's 97 Fahrenheit.
Well, that's at the high end, the very high end.
That's hot.
Yeah, it's hot. I would say, looking at this bit more closely, it's more like 27. After 27 C, it starts going downhill.
Okay, that's about 80. That makes a lot of sense.
Yep. And you hit that 36 C above that, it just drops off like a rock.
Oh, sure. Well, you mentioned that this went up to 45 Celsius. I mean, that's 113.
Yeah, you get down there and it's like nothing happening.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, leaf transpiration, so the amount of water that's evaporating out of the stomata, continues to increase, as one might expect, because the plant's trying to cool itself through evaporation. That seems like a no-brainer. But then we look at the efficiency of these photosystems. Photosystem 1, photosystem 2, and the electron transport chain. And what we find is that they show an efficiency that's pretty flat. It reaches its peak at about 30 degrees Celsius, and it's pretty flat all the way over to 41 degrees Celsius, and that just drops off like a rock. So the actual photosynthesis part, like the capturing of light energy, is stable at a much higher temperature than the actual ability of the plant to take that energy and turn it into sugar. You're like, wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because at this point, really what's important is this carbon assimilation. Where is there a difference in the varieties based on temperature? Because if James, you just said it really doesn't matter in the high temperature range, the photosystem really doesn't start to break down until you get to that, 41, 45 degrees C. And that's all due to that ion leakage I talked about earlier, electrolyte leakage. But up until that point, it's pretty much just an electron shuffle. There's not too many enzymes involved there. But now in carbon assimilation, it's all about enzymes. What we see is that Willamette, of all varieties that they tested here, has the highest level of CO2 assimilation at the highest temperature range. So it is still like leading the pack at temperatures as high as 40 C. And it's after 40 C where it drops off like a rock. Where something like Southern Brewer, you figured, hey, South Africa, they bred this thing to be. Yeah, no. It's right around like 30 C. After 30 C, boom, just drops off like a rock. Huh. So Willamette has the ability to produce sugars at much, much higher leaf temperatures than pretty much any of these other varieties that were tested. Chinook, lowest of the pack. Basically, what this says is Chinook hates heat.
And it's done well for us, so that explains a few things.
It does explain a few things. Cascade doesn't give two shits, and we've always said that about Cascade. Yes. It'll grow in a closet. Cascade's will. Like, meh. I think Cascade and Willamette are neck and neck, and it's probably within the margin of error, standard error on this, but
to your point, that's always been what we've said to brand new growers was, if you're just looking to figure out how this works, Cascade. Just do it.
Centennial, interesting enough, its peak is around 30 C, which is still pretty warm for that. We found that Centennial itself doesn't like high temperatures, performs better in lower temperatures. And if you look at the data, it does reflect that. It shows that it is a higher producing, has a higher level of CO2 assimilation at lower temperatures than some of these other ones. But it'll tolerate temperatures apparently up to right around 28 to 30 C, and then it's a pretty slow slide into death. So I think this is really, really interesting paper that shows, you know what, it's not necessarily that these plants are more, one variety is a better light harvester than the others. No, that's not the case at all. It's all about how well they can endure these higher temperatures? How robust is their enzyme system? How robust are their cell walls to withstand these high temperatures in order to keep this enzyme activity going to make sugar?
And you know, you hear, of course, anecdotally and experientially how growers have success or lack of success with certain varieties in certain areas. And look, science that proves out the why part of it.
Yep. Another factor that they looked at was something called stomatal conductance. So that's the...
Okay, that, well, you, how made, much that you made up.
Stomatal conductance, yeah.
I think I had some of that on my gnocchi the other night at the Italian.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
So the this is a rate basically of water leaving the stomata through evapotranspiration. Shocker, Cascade leads the pack. That may be an indicator as to why Cascade has the ability to assimilate carbon at a higher temperature, because it moves more water through its stomata and can keep itself cooler than these other varieties. Maybe.
Yeah, that's certainly a logical right. path to go down.
Right. But you see how there's, you know, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different metrics that this paper looks at to try and understand what's happening to these plants, to their photochemical system, based on different temperatures. And you just can't say, oh, well, look, I looked at its photosynthetic activity, and this one's better than this one, so this is going to equal the most yield. Uh-uh. Doesn't work that way. Doesn't work that way whatsoever.
I was just going to say, and I don't want to take you off the path you're on, and I may ask this question, and you may say next time, greenhousing.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
you have so much more control over all these things. And I have to imagine this kind of science will directly impact how greenhoused plants operate, because you can tailor all of this, the sunlight and the heat in particular, to your specific varieties.
You can, and which is what they did in this experiment. That's why you do these things in controlled environments, so you can control all these aspects. But is it cost effective? That's a whole nother story.
Cooling
a greenhouse is not cheap.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Not cheap at all.
You can always ask our friends at Sandy Ridge Farms about that.
Mm-hmm. You could, yes. Mm-hmm. So this last one I'm talking about is electrolyte leakage. And that's, you know, the cell walls basically getting leaky because they become super fluid. You know, like any cell walls are mostly fat, cell membranes, I should say. And as you heat up a vegetable lard, and it's solid at room temperature, you heat it up, it becomes liquid. Same thing happens with the membrane, right? That the warmer it gets, the more fluid it gets, and it can actually start to leak. And so of all these varieties, surprise, surprise, the varieties that showed the most leakage as temperatures increased were blah, 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 Centennial, Chinook, and Pride of Ringwood. Mm-hmm. If you get leaf temperatures over 40 or 39 degrees Celsius, for something like Pride of Ringwood, game over. it's a slow slide into death for that one. Actually, a pretty quick slide. But you know, that goes back to that what we just said about what we noticed about Centennial. Why does it do better in cooler climates? Now we have some understanding.
Any plans for a follow-up study to bring more varieties into the mix? Because this is really good information.
It's great. It's great information. And I think somebody could take this and build off of it. But there's no mention in this paper about follow-up and this is what should happen, blah, blah, blah. I would think that the great thing about scientific journal articles is they give their materials and methods. So anybody who has the wherewithal to want to do this could take and completely reproduce exactly what they did with other varieties and start mapping these, you know, the efficiency of the photosystems and carbon assimilation and stomatal conductance to understand what varieties might do better in different places. It's sort of a tease. Ultimately, where all this goes, though, is if you're not getting the yield that your plant should, and you've dialed everything in that you possibly could, and you're confident that there's nothing more that, you know, you can do and you're on your game, that plant physiologically may not be able to fix carbon at the temperatures or environmental systems that you're giving it, that you're putting it in. It's just not, no matter what you do, it's never going to yield well because it can't produce enough sugar. That's it. So look for a different variety. Well, James, which variety can I, should I look for? I don't know.
This is actually one of those few situations when we talk about the fact that you should talk to your neighbors, but every, you know, every field is different, but you know, you probably have a good sense for what works and what doesn't in your area.
Yeah, that's true. I don't want everybody using this as an excuse for their shitty yields either, that, oh, this plant isn't cut out for it. But what we, you know, we have, what I think this does more, what this paper does more for us is it helps explain our anecdotal evidence about, oh, this variety doesn't do shit for us here. Well, yeah, I could see that now because Chinook growing in South Carolina or Arkansas where it gets blazing hot in the summertime just doesn't do anything. Well, now I know why.
And yet, by the same token, we're going to get that comment or six of, I'm in Arizona and I've got great Chinook. Fantastic.
Well, yeah, what does that mean, great Chinook? And what elevation are you growing at? Because your daytime highs may not be all that high, mm-hmm. considering. I don't know. But just in general, yeah, I've got great Chinook. Okay, are you getting 2,000 pounds of the acre? No. Okay. So your Chinook are probably producing what it can under those conditions. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly not an optimized system.
And I think that's an important distinction here. It's you know, I'm going to go back to one of your lines. You can do whatever you want, mm-hmm. But it may not be optimal. You may find that there are other varieties that just will give you more bang for their buck in the environment you're in.
Yeah. And this is a very, very shallow dive into photosynthesis. Anybody wants to talk more about this, let me know. Certainly our Discord peeps. If you want to chat more about it, we can look at physiology here. But I think we need to have photosynthesis part two at some point here in the near future because there's a lot more data in just this one paper we can dissect.
I agree. And if you'd rather have a shallower dive, I can put you in touch with my 10th grader who's taking biology class right now.